Welcome, Father.
Thanks, Teresa. It's good to be back again.
It's great to be back, and we're in show number two. We had a great first program last week and jumped right into church history, and we I don't have my notes with me, I apologize, but we had a wonderful discussion and talking about the popes, and we began talking about the Avignon papacies.
That's right.
And I believe that's where we're going this week.
We'll be doing that this week, and we'll be looking at a little bit differently next week. In fact, the next couple weeks, we'll be looking at issues that the Avignon papacy had. It really is a fascinating period in church history. Church history is just fascinating to begin with.
Yes, it is.
Yeah, it really is. And the Avignon popes and the people who came in and out of history during that period of time are really fascinating. I had no idea until this past summer when I sat myself down with 3 feet of books over this and just read through this, how much the issues that took place during that 70-something years affected the church ever since and right down to today. And it's just really incredible.
Well, good. This will be interesting to learn about. Last week we also discussed of all the great theologians and philosophers that we lost right before this
yeah.
time.
Yeah, that's right. And after that period of time, then
quick transfer of a papacy,
The
turnover
rate
was
right.
intense.
And so you finally have some stability with the popes who decide to live in Avignon rather than in Rome.
Right.
There's some stability at this time, some real decisions that are made and some things that began happening that we look back on and kind of wish maybe they hadn't decided what they did. But nonetheless, they set a course for us. And so that's all part and parcel of our history.
All right. Yeah. That's great.
So I think what we're going to do this week is we're going to look at some of those popes. I want to zero in on three or four of them in particular.
Okay.
And then set up some of the issues. Next week when we come back, I want to look at the first of the Avignon popes all over again. That's Clement V.
Mm-hmm.
And look at the suppression of the Knights Templar.
All right. Okay.
And how that affects the church, why that happened and how that happened. The week after that, I want to look at the second of the Avignon popes, John the 22nd, who we'll look at again today, but from a different point of view and what was going on in the Franciscan order while he was pope and some of the alternative ecclesiologies, you could say, the way that the Christians look at the church and how that changes during his papacy.
Okay.
So, okay, we'll just jump right in on all of this.
Let's do it.
You know, in July of 1304, there was a conclave that was held in Italy, in Perugia. And this was a crisis conclave, because if you remember, Pope Benedict had died under ugly circumstances, mm-hmm. undoubtedly poisoned, probably by the French Chancellor Guillaume de Nogaret. And so now they had to come up with another pope. The one thing that is on the minds of all the cardinals, whether they be French cardinals or Italian cardinals or wherever they're from, the one thing that's on their mind is the bad relations between the King of France and the last couple popes, and they want to solve that. And they thought they had the answer by electing a non-cardinal. He was the Bishop of Bordeaux in southern France. His name was Bertrand de Gaulle, and although he's a Frenchman, he's actually from the area of Aquitaine, which was controlled by the English at the time. Okay, and he wins the election, first round, 18 cardinals voting, 12 of them voted for him, and so he accepts and chooses the title Clement V. Now, one of the great advantages of Clement V is that he is a personal friend of Philip the Fair, King of France.
Okay.
So they thought that they were going to then be able to build better bonds between the papacy and the king. Looking at his personality, most historians, and it doesn't make any difference whether they're secular historians, pro-Clement or anti-Clement historians, they pretty much all agree that he had a weak personality.
Okay.
He was easily impressed. He was impressionable mm-hmm. Personality. The other side of that is that made him a good diplomat.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
He was good at reaching compromises. And this could be a real asset. Another thing that was involved was right after his election. Remember how his predecessor died?
Yes.
Right, maybe it was nerves. I don't know. But he began having stomach problems.
Okay.
Since then, a lot of historians have concluded that he was probably suffering from stomach cancer.
Oh.
And, of course, they didn't have a lot of medical expertise at that time. So they didn't know what exactly was causing this. He thought, of course, that he was being poisoned.
Mm-hmm.
And so he became very recluse. He was elected in July of 1304. But all throughout July, all throughout August, he got sicker and sicker. And he would not see anyone. Only a couple of his nephews. Those are the only people that he could see, September, October, into November. And the cardinals are sending him messages like, you need to be installed. You know, we need a pope. You need to come out, you know. And finally, after all of that wrangling back and forth, and he started feeling a little bit better, he finally agreed to be installed as pope, to be coronated, mm-hmm. To receive the tiara, but not in Rome. And it would be done in the ancient Christian city in France of Lyon.
Okay.
So he agreed to do that, and he invited the King of France to be there.
Okay.
So this was going to be that great moment of the Pope and the King coming back together again, and everything else. It was a disaster. To begin with, as the procession is underway, there's this great procession. Crowds from all over the place came in, and many people crowded onto a wall. And as the Pope was passing by, the wall collapsed.
Oh, my.
And when that happened, some of the people in the procession were crushed. In fact, there was a duke that was crushed to death. And the Pope fell from his horse. The crown, the tiara, fell off. And a ruby that had been embedded there broke off and took off and somebody got it, but it's never been found ever since. Well, as if that's not bad enough. When finally the coronation was over and there was a quiet moment, the king leans over to the new pope and he says, I've got something bad to tell you. And he goes, what? And the king, Philip, said to him, he says, you know the Knights Templar? And he goes, yeah. He goes, it's a cult. And the Pope goes, no, it can't be. It's one of the great orders, the military orders of the church. He goes, I've got the goods in these guys. It's a cult. Well, actually, as we'll see next week, the whole thing is set up. It's not true.
Okay.
But you have a situation in which the Pope is confronted right during his coronation for all of this. So.
And they had had a friendly relationship prior to
yes,
this. So.
Yes. And this is going to strain their relationship,
mm-hmm.
but maybe it should have ended it, but mm-hmm. it didn't,
okay.
As we'll see later
okay.
on, to the detriment of the Knights Templar, because
mm-hmm.
the Knights were supposed to be protected. They were protecting the Pope. The Pope protects them, and in this case, he didn't do that. The Cardinals, immediately after, pleaded with him, go to Rome. That's where we're supposed to be. We're supposed to be going to Rome. And he goes, yeah, okay, yeah, we'll do that. But I'm not ready yet. I've got a couple more letters to write. I need to do this. You know, and it just never got around to it. It's not that he didn't do anything. While he was in Avignon in southern France, actually moving around quite a bit, he negotiates a peace between King Edward II and his barons, saving
okay.
England from a civil war. He negotiates the throne of Hungary and the next Holy Roman Emperor, saving Central Europe from another civil war. He negotiates in northern Italy among a number of states, and even went so far as getting the King of Naples to send an army to Rome to try to restore some kind of order in Rome. So even while he's away from Rome, but he's doing a lot of negotiating. He's doing what he does best, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
he finds compromises, negotiates with people. People flock to him with their problems. He's something like King Solomon
okay.
kind of a fellow. He establishes the University of Lyon, the University of Perugia. He sets up the medical faculties at Montpellier, one of the great French medical universities. Sets up a language, ancient language program for Hebrew, Syrian, and Arabic studies at the University of Paris, University of Bologna, Oxford, and Salamanca. So he is doing things.
He's doing a lot.
Yeah, he really is. He pulls together all of canon law into a corpus called the Corpus Juris Canonici. And so now all the laws of the church are there in those sets of volumes to do this. You know, so all of this is happening. And at the same time, he's also centralizing leadership within the church so that more and more we find, and this is a trend that's going to be very interesting, more and more he centralizes decision-making at the papal level.
Okay.
One thing that we take for granted today is the appointment of bishops.
Mm-hmm.
In all throughout Europe, there were many ways in which bishops came to be bishops. If you think back to the Middle Ages, that in the Holy Roman Empire, the emperor often had a controlling interest in who would become the next bishop of this or that diocese. Believe it or not, in some in a lot of dioceses all throughout the Christian world, it was the canons of a diocese. It was the cathedral choir. I don't mean the singing choir.
Right.
I mean
mm-hmm.
the priests
mm-hmm.
who would elect their bishop. Under Clement V, more and more, this becomes the exception rather than the rule. So he begins organizing and pulling more and more of these the authority away from the cathedral chapters to the papacy itself, so that he would be appointing these bishops. This is a very long a process.
I would think that would take a lot of organization.
Yeah, it really does. Now, the downside of all this organization is it costs a lot of money
mm-hmm.
because you've got to have scribes and you got to pay for the paper, which, of course, wasn't paper back then. It was parchment, so you got a lot of sheep running around. You know, this is a real challenge,
uh-huh.
And quite honestly, the papacy is poor. They
okay.
didn't have much money, and so they had to start looking for ways in order to bring in more money. And so what we find is that that they come up with ideas of fees, certain gifts
mm-hmm.
that are made. And so when decisions, you know, because there are more and more decision-making is being made at Avignon, then every decision has a price tag
mm-hmm.
on it. And as a result, people start looking upon what's going on as being a money operation. And in fact, St. Bernard of Clairvaux, before he died, said the very same thing. He said, this is a bad trend. This is not a good trend. And he could have predicted it. What was coming down the pike? It takes a couple more popes, but by Pope Benedict XII, who we'll be looking at a little bit later on, in 335, has made this thing a system, had gotten it to a system. And here are some of the trends that are underway. First of all, by Benedict XII, the papal leadership in the church was unlimited. Now, the quote that was used in one of the documents called Ad Regem says this. It says, all churches and all possessions of the churches are in the Pope's power. Well, we said, okay, fine. But look at the implications of that. What that means is that if the Pope is visiting in your diocese, okay, and he decides to stay at a particular parish, he can have the pastor's car.
Oh, okay.
You know? I mean, technically everything belongs to the Pope. And so
okay.
wherever he goes, he requisitions everything. Well, that's going to cause some hard feelings. It's one thing to say, you know, oh, you know, Holy Father, take my car.
Mm-hmm.
It's another thing with the Holy Father coming in and I'm taking your
car.
Give me your car. Yeah. You need a large bureaucracy. So you've got this absolute power that goes all the way into a rectory. At the same time, you have a large bureaucracy that's centering on the papal curia. Okay. And then at the same time, there's a real shift. We said something of this last week. A real shift in the spirit of the papal offices away from holiness and sanctity to things like law and business. Guy who knew how to turn the dollars. The guy who knew the canon law was the one who was going to be called upon more and more for service. Holy men are nice, you know, going off the side, say your prayers, but we've got to make money on this. You know, that's a bad trend. And as I say, Bernard of Clairvaux realized that early on. And then, quite honestly, the other problem is that the Pope spends himself too much time on politics, mm-hmm. too much time on business. John the 22nd, the second of the Avignon popes, historians have analyzed his budgets year by year. 63% of the papal budget went on war.
Wow.
You know, either buying somebody off or arming somebody or whatever. That's incredible. On the diocesan level and on the parish level, this causes nothing but chaos and confusion.
Mm-hmm.
You can imagine that a bishop, let me give you an example, that a pastor decides that he is going to erect a shrine, okay? And so he sends off to the diocese, to the bishop, and says, I'd like to build a shrine to, I don't know, St. Anne, whatever. And the bishop says, no, we already have a shrine to St. Anne. It's only a mile and a half away from where you're proposing one. Well, the pastor turns around and he writes to the Pope, writes to somebody in the Curia, and he goes, I'm trying to build this shrine, but this, you know, this bishop isn't listening to me. And by the way, here's a little gift, you know. And so this bureaucrat or somebody turns around, gets a papal signature, and sends back, yeah, go ahead and build your shrine. Well, how does that bishop feel? You see, it's a breakdown of authority.
Mm-hmm.
And by centralizing authority so much, you end up breaking it down. And so while all roads lead to quote-unquote Rome, or in this case in Avignon, it really leads to demoralization. You know what I mean?
Sure, absolutely.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It gets worse than that.
Okay.
It gets to the point where the Pope becomes very interested in not only who the bishops are, but who the pastor is.
Mm-hmm.
So let's say you have a situation in which a pastor passes away at a very wealthy parish. Okay. And the Pope then sends a legate down and says, don't name anybody, to the bishop, don't name anybody pastor. This is going to be a papal decision.
Oh.
Well, of course, once again, it undercuts the authority of the bishop.
Certainly.
And what is all the worse is then that until the Pope gets around to naming a pastor for this parish, like, doesn't he have anything better to do?
Well.
You know, then they don't have a pastor. What they have instead is an administrator who doesn't live at the parish, but rather lives at Avignon.
Mm-hmm.
So what the Pope does is he turns around to a maybe a secretary who is on a very, very modest income.
Mm-hmm.
But he's a secretary who has done some speech writing for the Pope or something, you know, done something for the Pope. Pope turns around and says, look, I'm going to make you the pastor of Saint-Sulpice Parish in Orléans or whatever. And I'm going to make you the administrator of it. Okay, and eventually we'll get a pastor there. But for now, you just administrate the parish. But you don't have to go there.
Oh.
Just sign the check, you know, just sign the checks. So this man probably never sees the parish, but guess what? He draws the pastor's salary.
Okay.
See what's happening?
Oh, yeah.
Is so the secretary, who is hardly paid anything by mm-hmm. the papal court, now receives a handsome salary from the parish that he never does any real work for,
mm-hmm.
and of course, who resents this but the parishioners?
Yes.
You know? And this became...
another priest serving the parish, I would assume.
Well, yeah, there's another priest in that parish. Yeah, this is just a lousy way of doing things. And so you have the beginning of a terrible abuse in the church called absenteeism. You know? And then on top of that, If this guy continues rendering even more wonderful services to the Pope, he might be named pastor of another parish mm-hmm. and another parish.
Oh, so
he might be getting three and four and five
mm-hmm.
incomes.
Mm-hmm.
Right. That's pluralism.
Mm-hmm.
Those are technical church terms, but there you have the situation in which you actually have a concentration of authority and power that is way beyond what it should be. And it's all being done here, there, in Avignon. This system made lots of money. To give you an example of this, I did some reading up on this and gathered some numbers in. I can't tell you what a florin is worth, but I got to do all this stuff in florins, which is the currency of the day. It takes 100,000 florin to run the papal offices a year, for a year.
Okay.
That's their budget. Just, okay, whatever it's worth. It's 100,000 florins. Okay. At their height, for 9 years in a row, the Avignon papacy was bringing in 200,000 florins a year.
Okay.
So they were doubling their budget.
Mm-hmm.
In
9 years, okay.
And it did it for 9 years. In other words, 100,000 surplus a year for 9 years.
Okay.
With everything they accumulated, by the time Clement died, the papal treasury had over 1 million florins in the treasury. Or at least that's what his successor thought. When he got in to take a look at the books, he found out that shortly before Clement died, he loaned 320,000 florins, divvying it up between France and England.
Wow.
That's a bunch.
That's a lot.
That's three times the annual budget for the whole papacy.
Wow.
He had some nephews that had some projects, and he lent his various nephews 300,000 florins. Other relatives got 200,000 florins. And another 200,000 florins went to charitable causes spread out throughout southern France. So when his successor, who was John the 22nd, became pope, he thought he had 1 million florins sitting in the bank. He had around 70,000 florins.
Oh, wow.
Isn't that something?
Wow. Yeah, that would be quite a shock to think you have 1 million and you have 70,000.
So what John the 22nd did was he said, how did this guy accumulate all this money? Let's double our efforts and do even better.
Okay.
Well, let me say some things about John the 22nd. This guy is really fascinating himself. Clement died during Easter of 1314.
Okay.
And when the conclave gathered together, it gathered in the northern part of the Avignon region. It's a beautiful little town called Carpentras. And the cardinals who gathered together were basically from three different groups. First of all, you had 10 cardinals from Aquitaine or Gascony, okay? These are all, this is the region that Clement V was from. It was their intention right from the beginning to elect one of his nephews. Maybe they're trying to get back some of that money, I don't know. But their intention was to elect one of his nephews as the next pope.
Okay.
You also had six other French cardinals who were real Frenchmen. Okay, they weren't in league with the King of England, and they didn't particularly care for these cardinals, and they certainly didn't want another Clement guy on the throne. And then you had seven Italian cardinals, and these Italian cardinals had their own idea of who they wanted. Actually, it was a Frenchman that they wanted. The long and short of it was that this conclave went on throughout May, June, July, vote after vote, no election. And finally, things got really kind of rough because word got back to Gascony that they had not elected a Gascon as pope. And a bunch of thugs from that part of France just left and they came over to Carpentras and they began beating up on Italians and killed a couple and began burning down houses where the Italian cardinals were sort of in order to induce them to change their votes. So this became really, really dangerous. The Italians fled Carpentras and it really looked like things were in terrible shape. This went on until March of 1316.
Okay.
No
Clement
pope.
Died in Easter 1314.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. So it's now been almost 2 years. Mm-hmm. And finally, one of the French princes, Prince Philip of Poitiers, offered to protect all of the cardinals if they gathered in Lyon for a conclave there. Well, they all did. and he sets up his own private army to protect them, and everything's fine. And then there was a crisis up in Paris that needed him and his soldiers, and so they all left, and the cardinals are there by themselves.
Oh, no.
So they fled to a Dominican house where they were boarded up and couldn't leave until they elected somebody.
Okay.
They finally, this is August, they finally decided the heck with it, anybody will do, and they elected somebody old, figuring it'd be a caretaker. He's not going to last long. They elected the Bishop of Avignon.
Okay.
Okay. He's also the Chancellor of the country of Naples. So he's got a couple of hats. He's 72 years old. So he's, you know, back then, that's a pretty old guy.
Right.
Not only that, he's also sick.
Oh.
Okay. So they elect this guy. He chooses the title John the 22nd.
Okay.
Okay.
This is August of 16.
Yes.
1816.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Right from the get-go, there's an assassination plot on him. If you could believe that. And it was perpetrated by a bishop.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. This fellow,
he wasn't taking any comfort in the fact that he was 72 and sick, I guess.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you, it wasn't really that he had anything against John the 22nd. The problem was that this particular bishop had been indicted in Avignon on corruption charges. And that
okay.
might be the pot calling the kettle black.
Yes.
But he was up on simony charges in a canonical court, and he thought that if he could create enough chaos by the newly elected pope dying, that he could get away with this. And so what he did was he was able to slip two of his loyal men into the papal household, okay, and they would do the dirty deed. He then decided to use sorcery to kill the pope.
Okay.
Oh, this is really weird. I had to read this in two different sources before I actually believed it.
Okay.
You know, because it really sounds like some sort of a novel. But that's exactly what he did. He sent off the treasurer of his diocese, the Diocese of Cahors, and he sends him off to a Jewish merchant, quote unquote, to buy wax figurines with incantations on them. He then wanted to try one out to make sure it worked, and he did an incantation on Jacques de Villa, the favorite nephew of Pope John the 22nd, who died.
Oh, no.
Yeah, so he figures, they do work. Okay, so he sent the treasurer back to buy a couple more. This time around, he brought them in, three more figurines. This guy is incredible. He brought them to his own private chapel, had some of the most prominent members of his inner household and the diocese at the chapel. And what they did was they baptized these three figurines. Then they put them into bread, baked them into bread, sent them on to Avignon with the intention of getting them physically close to the Pope so the incantations could kill him. In the midst of all of this, some papal guards discovered the figurines. The whole plot came out, but nobody could figure out who had sent them. Okay?
Okay.
It turns out that Bishop Giraud, who's the bishop who's doing all of this, started bragging to people that the Pope was going to die soon and all this kind of stuff. And so everything was traced right back to him. In May of 1317, he and a number of his accomplices were arrested. They were taken down on the charges of attempted murder of the Pope, of sorcery, and of murder of Jacques de Villa. And sure enough, they were tried, they were found guilty, and they were turned over to the secular authority, who then burned them at the stake.
Oh my gosh. Okay.
Isn't this something?
Wow.
So
that does sound like a novel.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, I want you to think back and think about
wow.
the last couple popes that we've had. Remember that St. Peter Celestine V resigned less than a year. Boniface VIII was practically beaten to death and died while imprisoned. Blessed Benedict XI was poisoned. Okay. Clement succeeded somehow in living. And then you have an attempted assassination against John the 22nd. Yeah, these were rough and tumble.
I can't imagine too many people vying for the title.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. These are really rough and tumble times. And you can see then that John the 22nd then tried to continue this centralization of authority and the accumulation of power, so if for no other reason than to protect himself.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the popes at this time honestly believed that this was the way to go.
So they're spending a good deal of time dealing with business matters. Anything spiritual happening?
No.
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 Okay.
No. A little bit later on, we're going to have a couple, St. Bridget of Sweden, mm-hmm. and St. Catherine of Siena.
Mm-hmm.
These are the two great lights of this era who will bring them back to senses. But both of them are just children while all this is going on.
Okay.
Yeah. You know, this is one of those cases, and I really got really excited about this. This is one of those cases when history goes in one direction so far, it creates the opposite move on the pendulum.
The pendulum,
you know,
uh-huh.
And this is exactly what happened. You know, it's sort of like history. There's one theory of history which is built on by a German philosopher by the name of Hegel. And Karl Marx used a lot of his stuff. He calls it the dialectic materialism. And this idea of a dialectic is that you have the creation of a pendulum swinging so far in one direction. He calls it the thesis. And it creates its opposite effect, the antithesis.
Okay.
You know?
Uh-huh.
And in a sense, this is exactly what happens. With John the 22nd, Clement the 5th, John the 22nd, and Benedict the 12th, all centralizing authority so much, it causes other people to start thinking, wait a minute, that's not right. And they came up with the exact opposite idea. One of those is a professor at the University of Paris. His name is Jean de Bouilly.
Okay.
Okay. He begins teaching in his classes and arguing and writing that the jurisdiction of bishops in their own diocese and parish priests in their own diocese become direct gifts and ordinations from God at the time of their ordination. Okay? So that when a man becomes a bishop, the moment in which he is ordained as a bishop, his responsibility is only to God, not to the Pope.
Okay.
And when a man is ordained given a parish as a pastor, his responsibility is directly as pastor to God.
Okay.
Not to his bishop and not to the Pope. Now you see that's an exact opposite. That's a radical decentralization,
mm-hmm.
that this man is arguing. And as a result of that, only the pastor or only the bishop is the proper administrator of the sacraments in that territory. That means technically that the Bishop of Rome can only operate as Bishop of Rome in the Diocese of Rome.
Okay.
That is an incredible argument and attack on the central authority of the Church. And what happens is that there is this big argument that takes place. Finally, John the 22nd realizes what a threat it is, and so he invites the University of Paris to send down a delegation represented by Jean de Bouillet to come down and to argue at Avignon their point of view. At the same time, others argued from the other point of view. This great debate took place in July of 1321. And in the end, the University of Paris was proven to be incorrect, that this simply was inconceivable, inconsistent with the traditions of the Church, with the history of the Church, with Scripture, and so they were proven to be wrong.
Okay.
They then turned around and basically said, well, I guess we're wrong. We lost the debate. They went back to Paris, and that was it. You know, there's no burning at the stake, nothing like that. It's an honest argument, takes place fine, then poof, then, you know, it's all over. And so with that, then things begin changing. At the same time, the court has already been set up, And so they started looking at other theologians. In fact, there are some 8 theologians that are brought in. Their works are looked at. Each of them are condemned as being heretical. Each of them say, oh, gee, I guess I misstated myself. Meister Eckhart, some of his writings, some 28 propositions by Meister Eckhart are found to be heretical. So there's a lot of this going on and all that. And then a very interesting thing happens. John the 22nd, the Pope, begins preaching heresy. This is really weird.
Okay.
Okay. On All Saints Day, in a sermon in 1331, he begins, and remember, he's 88 years old at this point.
Okay.
This is the guy that wasn't going to live long.
Right.
No? You know, 88 years old, and he begins preaching at that sermon that only the complete human being, body and soul, can come into the beatific vision at the time of the resurrection. Now, this whole beatific vision thing, we don't do much thinking about this or in those terms as much today, but boy, it was a big deal back then. Remember that when we speak of the beatific vision, we're talking about eternal bliss, coming into heaven. John the 22nd has just said, the Pope has just said in this sermon, that nobody can go to heaven until the final resurrection.
Right. What did that do to the people?
Oh, they went ballistic.
Yes.
You know, I mean, yes. I mean, it means all the saints.
Yes.
None of the saints. You know, right away he began getting tracts, letters from theologians saying, Holy Father, you need to rethink this position. This doesn't make any sense. Even Mary, at the time of her son, you know, and he was willing to concede that because it was body and soul. But boy, I tell you, you know, it just it caused everyone to be shaken. There were letters to the Pope asking him to reconsider what he was doing. He was actually preaching a form of Nestorianism, and yet he continued preaching this way. And this went on until a Dominican from England, a man by the name of Thomas Whaley, began preaching in Avignon against the Pope's preaching.
Okay.
And with that, word got back to the Pope. The Pope had him arrested, brought into the Inquisition, and he was tried as a heretic.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. The Inquisition looked at the arguments of Thomas Whaley, looked at the arguments of John the 22nd, and they came to the conclusion that Father Whaley was correct and the Holy Father was incorrect. And they said to John the 22nd, I'm sorry, but you're the heretic here. And at that point, he's on his deathbed and had only enough strength to say, I was not preaching as Pope. I was just doing this as a private theologian. He's like, maybe you shouldn't have done it to begin with.
Right.
You know? He died at the age of 90. But you can imagine how shaken the church was.
Oh, certainly.
You know, the next conclave that takes place, the one thing that's on their mind more than anything else is cleaning up the beatific vision thing.
Yes.
And so what they did was they elected one of the brightest theologians amongst them, who then took the title Benedict the 12th.
Okay.
One of the historians said that he's the brightest theological light in the Sacred College, and probably was. The other side of it is that he was personally a very disciplined, very austere, very hard man.
Okay.
And he intended to take care of the beatific vision issue, but he also intended to clean up the papacy at Avignon from top on down.
Was he successful?
You judge for yourself.
Okay.
Yeah. In fact, one of his nephews had written to one of the cardinals and said, oh, I'm so happy that uncle is now the Pope, and I'd like to come and visit. And Cardinal Bernard of Albi wrote back, we still have the letter, wrote back to his nephew and said the following, I quote here, you must know that in our master, natural affections have no voice. Don't come.
Wow.
The Pope doesn't want to see you. He could care less about family, friends, anything. I mean, when I say he's austere, he's austere. And so no affections had any control over him.
very hard for us to imagine in this day, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Well, very quickly, this brilliant mind set to rest the whole beatific vision problem. Okay, that's fine. That's taken care of. And then he turns his attention to the curia itself, and he says that he has found, quote here, abuses without number at court, and he was going to do something about it. He set up a special court of inquiry in January of 1335 and just announced that he was going to begin looking into corruption at court. You couldn't believe the number of bishops, cardinals, priests, monsignori, clerics, clerks, secretaries, the whole work. They all went home. I mean, he cleaned the place out, you know, in no time. They didn't want to be around for this inquiry. And so he basically told them, go home. I don't want you. I don't need you here. And they fled in large numbers. Salaries were set. People were going to be paid a decent wage, but they were not allowed to receive any bribes or any fees or any simony, anything like that. To become a member of his curia, you had to pass an exam. It was like a civil service exam. You know, I mean, this guy's really cleaning things up from top down. The bishops are told, don't stay here. When you come to Avignon to visit, you make your visit, then go back home. You got work to do back home. Not bad. After he cleaned up the curia and cleaned up his own top management, he then turned on the orders, the religious orders, and told them to start cleaning their act up too. There was a real problem, as we'll see a little bit later on with the Franciscans, but they weren't the only ones. A lot of monasteries had monks who never lived in the monastery. These were kind of footloose characters, you know, Friar Tuck kind of characters, you know, roaming around, drinking the beer, having a good old time, giving a blessing here and a blessing there and that kind of stuff, hearing confessions and all that, but not really living as a monk. There were a lot of monasteries that were like frat houses, you know, if you can imagine, you know, Animal House, St. Animal House, you know, monastery. And so he turns right away on these monasteries and says, you got to start cleaning up your act. His own home monastery at Citeaux in France, the great, you know, wealth of the fountain of the Cistercians, there was no work being done there. You couldn't say there was poverty being done there. It was a luxurious life. It was a nice, cushy life to be a monk at Citeaux. He instead turns around and gets a new abbot in there, and he begins putting abbots in various monasteries to clean these things up. The first thing he says is, you must receive the wandering monks back, the itinerant monks. When they come back, you have to receive them. And if they step out of line, you discipline them. And you've got my authority to do that. And so there's a lot of that that begins hunting. One historian said the following. This is a French historian of the 19th century. His name is Moyat, and he's just a real source of information. This is a quote from him on Benedict. He says, he hunted down monks who prevaricated, thwarted any resistance, deposed abbots, brought back the wandering monks by force to their monasteries, and gave the abbot of Citeaux extraordinary powers of jurisdiction. He then, after he turned on the Cistercians, he then turns on the Benedictines, did the same thing, turns on the Franciscans, did the same thing. We're going to see a little bit later on that this ultimately is going to cause a break within the Franciscans. And there's a movement called the Fraticelli. We'll talk about that a little later on, about poverty. And it really seems like a very esoteric topic. In fact, the author Umberto Eco writes a book about this, a novel. And it's a historical novel, but it's got a lot of its history is all mixed up. But anyway, it's a fascinating novel, and it's made into a movie, The Name of the Rose, if you remember that. Mm-hmm. This is all that same era. And so, you know, the Franciscans are lambasted. Heretical tendencies are rooted out, revolutionaries, the whole works. The same thing is also true with the, he then turns and he looks upon the Dominicans, and he has nothing but praise for the Dominicans. In fact, it's almost to the point at which the Dominicans are embarrassed. Every time he looks at another monastery, he goes, look at the Dominicans, look at the Dominicans. You know, and of course, they don't, these other monasteries are nothing like but jealous. Well, anyway, he's Pope for 8 years. And by the time he dies, the church has almost not changed at all.
Oh, really?
Isn't this something?
That is.
And you know why? Because he was reforming the church from the top, and it never got down. He reformed the curia.
Okay.
He sent the bishops home.
Uh-huh.
You know? He cleaned up the monasteries. But all throughout the whole rest of the church, the average, you know, Christian in the pew was not affected by any of this.
Wow.
There were tremendous religious movements underway
mm-hmm.
at the time. But the popes didn't tap into those in any way. It's so much the opposite. I just, you know, you like to balance two opposites off. It's so much what Benedict the 12th tried to do mm-hmm. and didn't accomplish. Look at Pope John Paul II, and he's tapping into the youth movement mm-hmm. in these monster rallies, these mm-hmm. huge World Youth Days. You know, here's somebody that's going right to the pews themselves, right to the common people, and really reforming the church
mm-hmm.
from the bottom up.
Right.
These popes, and particularly this pope, went from the top down. And so by the time he died, he had a very disciplined home office,
yes.
headquarters,
yes.
but not a heck of a lot. He not much of an accomplishment beyond that.
Okay.
His successor would be plagued, literally. It's during the time of Pope Clement VI that the bubonic plague struck Europe.
Okay.
And Avignon was one of those first to be struck. It's in southern France. It's along the Mediterranean. In April of 1348, over half the population of the city of Avignon was killed off.
Wow.
The Pope was not in Avignon. He was actually in Valence. And when word came to him of what was happening in Avignon, he went back. That's an incredibly gutsy thing to do.
It really is.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I don't think I would have.
Your population has just died.
Yeah. The first 6 years that he had been pope, he was very gregarious,
uh-huh.
Just having a grand old time. You know, he was enjoying the papacy. He had a couple great quotes. One of his quotes was, he says, "My predecessors did not know how to be pope." Well, that's nice. "No one should leave the prince's presence dissatisfied."
Okay.
"A pontiff should make his subjects happy." We started giving away all the money that's been accumulated all over again. And so he's spending all the surplus, you know, having a grand old time. He is the one, Clement VI is the one who builds the incredible papal palace of Avignon. You see pictures of this thing. It is just absolutely incredibly massive. He loans money to France in order to continue the Hundred Years' War when France went broke. But now there's the crisis. He takes the money that's still there and hires doctors and hires anyone who could care for these people who are dying of the bubonic plague. He hires carters to come in and to cart off, mm-hmm. you know, in wagons the dead. He hires grave diggers. You know, there's so many people dying so rapidly. Mm-hmm. So he's hiring all of these. He's establishing a large cemetery so that people could receive their Christian burials. At the same time, he also oversees the establishment of very strict police measures. Boarding up of houses where the plague had broken out. And then he has the foremind to give special indulgences to any priest who would stay with his people during the time of the plague. If you look at the statistics, priests died off like you wouldn't believe.
Hmm.
Because as they're going to give last rites to these people, remember this is a pneumonic plague. They're sneezing and mm-hmm. coughing and spewing mm-hmm. this disease into priests' faces. Mm-hmm. And so they die at a much more rapid pace than even the whole general population. Volunteers are given special dispensations and special indulgences. Also, Clement found out that a lot of people were blaming the Jews for this plague. And he himself announced an excommunication on any Christian who molested Jews because of this. Did this twice during his 1348, gave protection to Jews in the papal territories. Any area of Europe that was owned by the Pope became free territory that Jews could go and would be safe from retribution by the Christian populations. A lot of people don't know a lot about that, but this is one of those cases, and I found historical evidence that shows this. Well, he himself died in 1352.
Did he die of the plague?
No, he didn't. Interestingly enough, he died of an internal cyst in his stomach.
In 32?
Yeah, okay. Yeah, 1532. There are going to be...
1332.
Yeah, 1332. There'll be three more Avignon popes that'll follow after him. They pretty much are doing the same thing. They're trying top-down reform, not terribly successful. At the same time, they're failing to tap into popular piety, especially after the bubonic plague. Two opposite things happen. You have people who turn absolutely against religion.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's one of these, eat, drink, and be merry, tomorrow you will die.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one of the phrases that was used so often among young people at the time was, timor mortis conturbat me, the thought of death confounds me. So I'm not going to think about it, you know. And then there's the other group that turns all the more to religion and to the solace that religion offers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the cult of Saint Sebastian is so popular at this time. Because remember, Saint Sebastian is killed by arrows.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's that phrase in the office in the evening, the 1,000 fall at my side and 10,000 at my right side, near me it shall not come. Mm-hmm. And so there's this this strong fervor that... But the popes don't tap into that, into what eventually develops as the Devotio Moderna. They don't.
I would think that part of why it's so much easier now is the ease of communication.
No doubt about it.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It takes quite a while to get, and especially at a time when a third of the population of Europe has died off
mm-hmm.
in a matter of 2 or 3 years. That's as bad as a nuclear exchange.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know?
Right.
So you can imagine that the communications would have been very terrible.
Yeah, very difficult.
Some of the religious orders are absolutely devastated through this. One example of that I came across was in Persia in the East, which was even at this time, although it was a Muslim country, there was still a very strong Christian presence. The Dominicans had 15 monasteries in Persia, and only three of them survived the plague. 12 of the 15 monasteries were wiped out.
Wow.
You know, the Knights Hospitallers, the Knights of St. John of Jerusalem, all needed help and reform too. Ultimately, the last Avignon Pope is going to be Gregory the 11th, and he will be convinced by Catherine of Siena to go back to Rome and end the Avignon Papacy.
All right, and we'll look at a little more at that next week.
2 weeks from now,
couple
weeks from now. Next week, we're really going to look at the beginning of the Avignon Papacy and look at Clement V and the suppression of the Knights Templar.
Oh, right, right.
Yeah.
That's right.
So we'll be spending some time in Avignon.
Okay. Great, Father. Well, would you close today with us?
Sure.
With a prayer and a blessing.
Certainly. And as we do that, particularly we want to remember the Archbishop who will be going under surgery next week. And we just ask God to be with him throughout this time and ask God to send the angel to guide the surgeons in their work. And we just really pray that the Archbishop uses this time to get a little rest. He works so hard for us, and that he be restored to health and brought back to us.
Absolutely.
Glory to the Father, to the Son, and to the Holy Spirit.
As it was in the beginning,
is now, and ever shall be.
World without end. Amen.